Okay, well, first, thank you for inviting me. My name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Sgan Rosh Beit Midrash of the YU Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I work with the Reuter Chiner, who I know many of you know, as he's given this class many times, I know, over the years. A little bit more, I guess, about my bio. I grew up in Staten Island in New York. I married a Torontonian, which is, you know, one of the reasons I ended up here. My wife's from Clinton Park area. I went to YU for undergraduate. I majored in philosophy, Jewish studies. I have a master's in Jewish philosophy from YU, from Bernard Revel Graduate School. I have smicha from YU. My wife and I are here we're just finishing our second year. We'll be here probably one more year. We have a house being built in Efrat. In Israel, we were in Israel before. Assuming the house is built on time, then it's ahead of schedule, so we're hopeful. And that's about it. We have two little kids, a 4-year-old and an almost 2-year-old. Okay, so what I want to do today is try to speak about maybe more general issues in the way Agnon writes. We're going to focus on one story. In fact, maybe not arguably, his most famous story, the one from which he derived his pen name, Agnon. But I don't want to focus just on the story. I want you to use it as a jumping-off point to really understand the methods of Agnon in his writing. So before we get to the story of the Aguna, a little bit of an introduction. So Agnon, as was celebrated, I guess we're finishing the year now, is the only Israeli writer to have ever won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Many Israelis have won the Nobel Prize for the sciences, for mathematics, for economics, but for literature he's the only one. And that was 50 years ago. And in his statement, when he received the award, in his Nobel Prize address, he speaks a little bit about where his inspiration came from. And he writes in source one, we can just look at it in English, but I gave you his original as well. In the original they read it in translation as well. The Nobel Committee was not literate in Hebrew, so it was translated then. So I feel less bad using his translation. But he writes that first and foremost, there are the sacred scriptures, from which I learned how to combine letters. He said there were many influences in his life, but the first and foremost, what really started him off was the Torah. Then there's the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Midrashim and Rashi's commentary on the Torah. After these come the Poskim, the later explicators of Talmudic law, and our sacred poets, the medieval sages, led by our master, my Moses, son of Maimon, known as Maimonides of blessed memory. When I first began to combine letters other than Hebrew, I read every book in German that came my way, and from these I certainly received according to the nature of my soul. As time is short, I shall not, that should have been not, but I took this translation from the official website, I shall not compile a bibliography or mention any names. Why then did I list the Jewish books? And he said, look, there are many influences in my life. But when he talked about the German books, he just said, the German books. But when it came to the Torah, he goes through details. It's the Torah, meaning the Chumash, and the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the decisors of Jewish law from Maimonides and on. He said, why do I list them? Because it is they that gave me my foundations, and my heart tells me that they are responsible for my being honored with the Nobel Prize. Agnon himself attests to the fact that it's something about the Torah, something about his exposure to Torah, that gave him that inspiration to write the way he did. And he declares that along with him, as it were, not only is he getting the Nobel Prize, but belatedly, God is getting the Nobel Prize with him, and the prophets and the like, for their excellent work, the best-selling books in history. And I want to take Agnon at his word. Now, anyone who's read Agnon knows that you can't go a sentence in Agnon without him drawing on Jewish sources. But I think that it's more than that. It's not just that Agnon draws on Jewish sources, but I think he's actually inspired by the way the Torah is written, because the Torah, especially the Torah, is not just a law book. It's literature. It's great, inspired literature, but it's literature. and it's full of poetry and beautiful prose. But it's also full of all types of hidden language and symbolic language and hints and allusions and every literary device that barely had a name until the last few hundred years can be found in different places in the Torah. And if one is a careful student, and as careful a student as Avraham was of Torah, and one has a literary soul, then one can't help but absorb those methods, those inspirations from the Torah. And I want to try to understand what really the purpose is of this type of writing, of writing that uses tremendous amount of allusion, which draws on other sources, that expects cultural literacy. What exactly do you accomplish by using allusion? So here I want to use a parable, which I heard once from Rabbi David Foreman in explaining the Torah, but I think it helps explain what Agenon was doing, what it was he got from the Torah. So if I asked you, why is it that a writer, or in the case of the Torah, God, why would any writer, especially God, why would he use language which is elusive, not elusive, but elusive, right, that alludes to things? Why wouldn't he just tell you what he means? Right, if he wants to connect two stories. So why don't you just say, these two stories are connected? You know, take any example, right? You know, we could... Pinchas and Eliyahu, right? That, to take last week's parsha, right? Chazal pick up on this in the Midrashim. The Chazal say Pinchas is Eliyahu. Pinchas is Elijah, because they're both these zealots. Now, what exactly they're getting at, they're clearly connecting the two stories, but the Torah never explicitly connects them. It does use the same language, though. Right? Kano kineti, that I was zealous in the double form, they use in both cases. And it forces you to combine the stories, or at least understand them in light of each other. Now, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just say, you know what, let's write a treatise on zealotry, and now let's go through all zealous acts, and let's, let's analyze their zealotry. It's positive, it's negative. Why wouldn't you do that? Why would you allude to it and force the reader to think about it? And there's many answers to this question. I want to try to build on as many of them as I can. So one is exactly that, is I think it forces the reader to engage. Right? It forces the reader to engage. And take that more, it's not just forces the reader to engage, it forces the reader, if he or she wants to engage, to be culturally literate in the books that the author thinks are important. Right? It's not just enough to engage if you're engaging so you could write in hidden language. But if you engage in elusive language where you're referencing other stories, you're also requiring a cultural literacy, because otherwise you'll just miss the allusion. Ray Foreman has a really nice parable for this, and he says, if you want to think about the Torah, or any great literature, think of it like real estate. Okay? If you have $50 million to invest in real estate, okay? So, if you take that money and you invest it in Nunavut, right, how much land do you get? A tremendous amount of land. If you invest it in downtown Toronto, how much do you get?
Nothing.
Right? Not so much, right? You get, I don't know, a few hundred square meters, right? So what do you do with that land? In Nunavut, what do? Well, let's say you need to house 1,000 people and you have $15 million to invest in Nunavut. So what do? You build many, many houses which are very well insulated, right? And you give everybody their own backyard if they want, and, you know, their huge backyard, acres and acres of land, whatever you want. If you want to house 1,000 people in downtown Toronto and you have $50 million, what do? You build up. You build up and down. Right? Foreman suggests that's how we have to relate to good literature, and especially Torah. The Torah is the most valuable literature, real estate, in the history of the world. If you want to build in meaning, you don't build meaning lengthwise. You don't spell out everything you want to do, because that just takes up space. What do? You build up and down. But how do you build up and down? How do you build an apartment building, a skyscraper, in literature? Through allusion. Because what does allusion do? Without you spelling out what you're saying, you bring two stories into conversation. or three stories, or four stories into conversation. And by bringing multiple stories into conversation without saying anything, you've now added, if it's four stories, four layers at least of meaning to the story you're reading without adding space. So illusion, literary tools, force you to engage the text. They force you to have cultural literacy, and they also enable you to pack meaning into individual words, into individual sentences, pack layers and layers and layers of meaning without saying too much. But in fact, you say more than you could have if you'd spelled it out in endless prose. And if you think about what Agenon does exactly that, right? You read one story, and even a short story, and you're engaged suddenly not just in whatever German works it is that he's reading, but in the Midrash, and in the Tanakh, and in the Rambam, and in Hasidish tales, and suddenly you're in conversation with multiple worlds. He didn't even tell it to you. But if you want to understand his story, you're suddenly in conversation with layers and layers and generations of writers and readers and interpreters of texts and livers of tradition. If you want to get into the text, you've got to enter that skyscraper and you've got to go from floor to floor and understand how did you build from floor one to floor two. And it forces you to enter. It forces you to come in and not just run through it. If you want to understand him, you've got to enter, you've got to immerse. And one of the ways to do it, and this is what we're going to focus on, is by using symbolic names. Because symbolic names is a great way of doing that, because a name takes up so little space, and you can imbue so much meaning into a story by a name. Now, this is not just true in literature, this is true in life. I mean, you think about what we do when we name our children, and we speak at the Brit or the Simchat Bat, or, later at a wedding, and we say, you were named for my grandmother, and she was named for her grandmother, and these are the traits I want to pass on to you. We're packing meaning into our children by naming them, right? We're not telling them, we're not giving them a laundry list of qualities we want them to have. We're giving them a name, and we're hoping that everything that name represented for us, our child will get some of that, will be inspired by some of that. We do this with names all the time in real life. In literature, it's even more because, it's a constructed text, right? And Agenon is the master of it. And if you want to understand how he uses symbolic names, the best place to start, in my opinion, is with his name, right? With Agenon. The name he took is from that first story he published when he came to Israel. I'm going to be careful. In English, this story is normally translated as the Aguna. I translate it as Agunot. In Hebrew, it is Agunot. The reason I did that is, first of all, it's the literal translation, but also, and I sent this to Shoshana to send out, and we won't get too much into it, but the truth is that Agenon actually really loved this notion of Aguna to the point where he actually has two stories. One is the famous one called Agunot, and another is one that was long lost called Ha'aguna, the Aguna. And this one was finally reprinted in a recent article by Hillel Weiss, which I sent out. It's not on these store sheets, so maybe we'll get to it, but I doubt it. But the truth is that Agenon is very careful. He has one story which is Agunot and one which is Aguna, Ha'aguna. So I'm going to translate it as Agunot to be true to what he meant. Right? The Aguna is just a different story of Agenon. But, if you want to look at a story where names are going to be important, it has to be the one which he took his name from. Right? There's something, not only is he going to pump meaning into the names in Agunot, but the story is going to tell you who he is as a person, right? That's the name he takes. That's his pen name. That's the name that's going to be on top of every other story he writes. Okay. So, let's quickly just summarize the main points of the story of the Agunot. Okay, we'll come back to details, but let's get the main points down. So help me out, anyone who's read the story, right? Agunot starts with who are the protagonists in it? We have the father, Right? We have Achiezer, right? We have the famous, right, the wealthy father-in-law, right, Achiezer. Right? Then he has a daughter, Dinah. Right? Dinah. Right? He wants to marry Dinah. Now, he moves from Europe, from Poland, to Israel. And he wants to build a beautiful yeshiva with a shul attached to it. And he sends for the greatest scholar. And instead of finding a scholar in Jerusalem, he finds a scholar in Poland, which he brings to be his son-in-law, named Yechezkel. Named Yechezkel. And he hires an artist, Ben Uri, to build the Aron Kodesh, to build the Ark for his beautiful shul. And Ben Uri, while building the shul, also has a beautiful voice. And as he builds, he sings. And Dinah hears his song and falls in love with Ben Uri, though he doesn't quite return her love, but she pines away for him. In the meantime, the wedding day is approaching, and then right before the wedding, one night, so Ben Uri finishes the Aron. And then he needs to go out and, you know, and clear his mind. He feels like he's being swallowed up by haughtiness, at the, you know, impressed by his own beauty that he's created. He goes out into the garden, and Dinah decides, she's been pining away from him. She goes and looks for him, and he's not there. And instead, she sees the Aron, and she goes into a fit of rage because Ben Uri hadn't returned her love. He poured all his love into this piece of art. So she shoves it out of the window. And the next day, everyone assumes that it must have been for some inexplicable reason. It must have been Ben Uri who destroyed it himself. So they decide they're not going to use the Aron. Ben Uri leaves the city, and they banish the Aron to some storage room, never to be used, and they put up some other makeshift Aron. In the meantime, the wedding day approaches. It's a very melancholy day. No one quite knows what's wrong. But the day before her wedding, you know, she goes to the rabbi and she starts crying and she admits everything she's done. And the rabbi tells her, "Don't worry. The day of the wedding is like Yom Kippur. You'll be forgiven." But in the meantime, you know, they realize Ben Uri was not guilty. They try to return the Aron to its proper place, but it's disappeared. And they get married, and their wedding doesn't quite, you know, they get married, but they never are able to consummate the marriage. And then we find out that Yechezkel, the husband, is in fact also has his love, Fredela, who's in Europe, who's still in Poland. She was the daughter of the person who worked for his family in Poland. And then he gets a letter one day that she's getting married, and he can't handle it, so he leaves. He goes back to Poland. They get divorced, and the rabbi gets a dream in which he's he's accused for having trapped all these souls, and therefore he goes off into the world to find penitence. And he says he's going out to fix all these souls that are agunot, that are literally chained or moored, right? Really anchored, right? And ogen is just an anchor, to go fix them. And then it ends on this mystical note that, you know, every so often someone thinks they see the rabbi, right? He disappears off into this mystical existence, but every so often he's seen, right? That's the basic gist of it. And we'll come back to details of the aguna. Now that word, right? The title of the book, Agunot. So if you look at number 3, I gave you the two lines that it comes from. It comes from two sentences towards the end of the book. One is Ad matai te agna nishamot shebo lamecha v'sheiradecha lecha te'egen nechayim. Until when shall the souls within your world be anchored, and how long shall your temple song lament completely stricken? And the second is, when the rabbi leaves, he turns to his daughter and says, "Biti, al tivak sheni, don't bother looking for me, don't seek me out. Chovat galut net chayavti, I have incurred the penalty of exile, l'takein agunot, to fix or restore the anchored souls, the moored souls of the world." And the framing of this book, both in the title and in these closing lines, is this image of the aguna, of these souls who are anchored, who are moored, who are chained. So to understand the book, well, we got to figure out, okay, well, where, or the story really, so where did that come from? The word, aguna, that phrase, te agna, where did it, what is the inspiration for the story? Right, why is it called this? What is the theme behind the story? So where does the phrase come up? The phrase comes up in the book of Ruth. And the word Te'agna comes from the book of... What? Te'agena, really, right? Te'agena. Te'agena is from the book of Ruth. Technically the first chapter. So here's the story. I put the whole, a good part of the book there. But here's the story of the book of Ruth. So in the book of Ruth, it starts off, and it starts off in the days of the judges, right? We can look at it in English quickly, right? In the days when the chieftains ruled, the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah with his wife and two sons went to reside in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and his two sons were Machlon and Kilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem in Judah. They came to the country of Moab and stayed there. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah, the other Ruth, and they lived there about 10 years. Then those two, Machlon and Kilion, also died. So the woman, meaning Naomi, the mother, was left without her two sons and without her husband. So she started out with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. From the country of Moab, she had heard that the Lord had taken note of his people and given them food. Accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living, and they set out on the road back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Turn back, each of you, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead men and me. May the Lord grant that each of you find security in the house of a husband." And she kissed them farewell. They broke into weeping and said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Turn back, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I any more sons in my body who might be husbands for you? Turn back, my daughters, for I'm too old to be married. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I were married tonight and I also bore sons." And here's the key. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Now we'll look at the Hebrew, because this is where it comes from. It says, "Halohein te shaberna, ana sher yigdalu, halohein te agena, vivilteya yoleish, al benotai, ki marli ma'od mikem, ki atza bi yad adonai." He says, should you wait for them to grow up? Meaning, even if I had new children, what would you do? You'd wait to marry them. You can't marry them till they're adults, right? At least legal adults reach the age of majority till 13. And it's going to take a while. I need to find a new wife, a husband. I need to have kids. And then, still, there'll be many years you're junior. And you'll be stuck. Should you be on their account, debar yourselves from matters, right? Which is not a great translation. It's really, should you be anchored to them, right? "Oh no, my daughters, my lot is far more bitter than yours, for the hand of the Lord has struck out against me." And she says, right, do you really want to be anchored? Do you want to be chained to my not yet born son? Move on with your life. And this phrase becomes the image that is nowadays, now the phrase is known as an aguna, right, which classically meant a woman whose husband, we don't know whether he died, and therefore she can't remarry because she doesn't know whether her husband is dead or not. And nowadays has been used for a woman whose husband doesn't want to give her a get, doesn't want to divorce her, and therefore she's stuck in a dead marriage. It comes from this phrase. So you can't help but wonder what influence did the Book of Ruth, not just that one line, but what influence did the Book of Ruth have on the story of the Agunot. So since our focus is on names, that's what I want to do. I want to start with the book of Ruth for a moment, and let's try to understand what Ruth is about just a little bit, and note something weird, which is that Ruth, this is true of many books in Tanakh, but it's especially true of the book of Ruth, plays with names in masterful, masterful ways. So if you start the book, let's go back to the beginning, right? "It was in the days when the chieftains ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah, with his wife and two sons, went to reside in the country of Moab." So first verse, what are the names of the protagonists?
No idea.
We have no idea. What's the effect of that literarily?
It's
It could be anyone, and therefore it could also be everyone. Right? It could be anyone, it could be everyone. Right? The story starts off, before we find out who it is, as a story about a man who left Israel with his wife and his children. So right off the bat, and the Midrashim build on this, they say, well, yeah, it's about Elimelech fleeing Israel, because Israel is suffering because there's a famine, and he's a leader, but he doesn't want to take responsibility for the people in Israel, so he flees to Moab. But that person in the first verse is nameless, which already tells you that by leaving out names, the book is telling you this could be anybody. This could be the story of anybody's complex relationship with the land and people of Israel. And then we learn their names. The man's name was Elimelech, right? This story, particular story, does have a name, do have names involved. His wife's name was Naomi. And his two sons were named Mahlon and Kilion. Now, what do Mahlon and Kilion mean? Right? Because Mahlon and Kilion are actually symbolic names. But it's not actually clear what the names mean. Because Mahlon, for example, can mean one of two very different things. Mahlon can either come from the name, from the word Michol, right? Which is a circle or circle dance, right? As the Gemara outlines at the end of Ta'anit. Right, so it could be a very happy name. Right? It can also come from the word machala, right? Disease. Now, that tells you that the first verse is ambiguous. Right? His name is clearly symbolic. His parents probably named him for the good reason, right? That he's dancing, he's joyous. But his fate tells you that it portended a different destiny, which was machlon, that he would die of illness, he would die young. Kilion, on that note, means destruction, Klia. So Ruth, or the book of Ruth, starts first of all with the being nameless, and then once it introduces names, it gets ambiguous names, which could have been good names, could be bad names, turn out to be bad. So already by the second verse in Ruth, the book tells you that names are going to become important because they're going to tell the story. They're going to hide the story. And then his wife is Naomi. Now, Naomi is clearly a good name, a really good name, right? It means, right, it comes from Naim, right? It's pleasant. So there's no two ways about her name. But because there's no two ways about her name, skip for a moment to 19, actually. So the middle of the story is famous. Ruth Orpah goes home. She listens to her mother-in-law and says, you know what, I have nothing with you. Ruth says, under no circumstances, your God is my God, your people are my people, I'm going back with you no matter what happens. So they go back to the city. And in verse 19, and the two went on until they reached Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole city buzzed with excitement over them. The women said, can this be Naomi? And what does she say? Do not call me Naomi, she replied. Call me Mara, call me bitterness. For Shaddai, for God, has made my lot very bitter. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. How can you call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me, when Shaddai has brought misfortune upon me? So her name is not ambiguous. But if it doesn't represent her destiny, what does she say? Change it. Right? My name might be Naomi, but that's not my identity. So call me Mara. So already in the first chapter, we start with ambiguity of names, to open the possibility that this story could be about anybody. And then when we learn the names, we have ambiguous names that portend two different destinies. And then we have someone whose name tells a specific destiny, but it's not the life she lives. So she changes her name. Right? So the book of Ruth opens by playing with your head with names and by building meaning through names. But I'll also tell you something really interesting, and this will become important. So I noticed in some later scholars on Agnon. Little question. We learned about the sons of Elimelech, Mahlon and Kilion. We know they're married to Ruth and Orpah. Who's married to who? We don't find out. We find out at the end. We find out in chapter 4. There's only four chapters. We find out in chapter 4. But he holds it over your head. He doesn't tell you. The author doesn't tell you. Who's married to who? Why? What does that tell you? That who's the protagonist of the story? Ruth, right? Not her husband, and that the story, right, the story of Ruth is going to go on about how she eventually remarries and eventually has a child that will help comfort Naomi. But by not telling you who she's married to, even though it's true that in the event eventually she'll marry someone and redeem her husband's name, and well, it's not clear, right? By hiding her husband's name till the end, first of all, it tells you that Ruth is the hero, right? She's a heroine, rather, right? Not, the husbands aren't so important. It also can do one of two things. It can either be telling you that Ruth is really redeeming the whole family and not just her husband. The fact that she happened to be married to one of the two sons is incidental, right? We find out in chapter 4, but that's not the real drama in this story. It's that she's redeeming Mahlon, Kilion, and Elimelech, meaning she's really saving Naomi from her fate. And that's one possibility. Or alternatively, we find out in chapter 4 who she's married to, right? If you look, I gave this to you in chapter... Did I give it to you? I didn't give it. We find out she's... I didn't give you where we actually find out the name of her husband. We find it out in the context of the actual redemption, right? She ends up coming. There's the whole story in the middle where she marries, right? She has to go back and forth, and she seduces Boaz, who's a lost relative, and then he redeems the brother. And then, what? her husband is Kilion. Right, I think she's married to Kilion. I might be mixing it up. See, this is the problem, right? I think, am I even messing it up? I'm not even sure. I don't know if I got it right. But then we find out who she's married to. Now, you could also read the story as saying that until Boaz redeemed his memory, he had no name. He became nameless. Right? Even though he has a name, he's really nameless because you don't know who he is. You don't know who's being redeemed until he's actually redeemed. And the story is about him getting his name back. Right? And then, right, the book of Ruth, in the most striking moments, when Boaz, who's the hero of the story, is going to eventually marry Ruth, there's actually a closer relative who's offered to marry Ruth. Right? And he turns it down. And what's his name according to the book of Ruth? Ploni Almoni, which means anonymous, right? John Doe, right? Because since he doesn't want to redeem the memory of Ruth's husband, he loses his own memory, right? So the book of Ruth is a four chapter book, which names run through the whole book, right? It opens with symbolic names, and it closes by telling you that he who has courage, right, will be remembered. He who doesn't try to commemorate others will not be remembered. Right? It plays with names. So the book of Ruth is in the background to the story of the Agunot, right? It's the framing. That te'agna, that word, comes from the book of Ruth. But now let's push a little bit farther. The book of Ruth, as I said, is a story about, on the one hand, yes, a family that leaves and is bereft and then eventually finds consolation. But it's also the story, as I mentioned, of a family's complicated relationship with the land of Israel. Right? Sure. Thank you. And it's the story.
We had that theme in the Bible with Abraham. We had that theme with... So it's an old theme in the Bible.
Right. It's an old theme in the Bible, for sure, right? Abraham leaves.
Usually went to Egypt, but here they went to Moab, when maybe the enemy...
Correct, right? This is a theme that appears many times. But in Ruth, right, which is the book that the title derives its name from, right, the Agunot, right, Te'agna, right, the book of Ruth is almost a meditation on this story. Because the whole story is what happens when somebody, as Chazal understands, the Midrashim understand it, abandons the land and the people of Israel because he doesn't want to take responsibility for people when the country is suffering. He wants to find his lot elsewhere. It turns sour because he can't find happiness outside of Israel. His wife returns to Israel thinking that there's nothing there for her and finds that hope surprises her. Right? It's a meditation about a family's struggle with the land of Israel. And if many commentators have suggested, that's really what the story, the Agunot, is about. It's not just about these couples, right? Yechezkel and his wife Dinah and his love Fredela and her love Ben Uri. It's a meditation on the Jewish people's relationship to the state of Israel, because Agnon had a very complicated relationship. On the one hand, he was a Zionist, but he goes back and forth, and he sees no hope in Europe, but he still has a connection to the culture, and he does go back for a few years, and he's always struggling in his life with the land of Israel. It defined who he was, and many have suggested that the story of the Agunot is a meditation on how complicated the relationship of the modern Jew is to the state of Israel, coming from Europe, leaving Europe, and coming to Israel, but still holding on to a foreign culture and how to forge a new culture and never being part of this culture and not that culture and going back and forth emotionally, psychologically, existentially. And because that defined who Agnon was after he wrote this parable of the struggle of the modern Jew with the state of Israel, he names himself Agnon because that's who he is. And with those... What? You're not the state, you're right, meaning it's the land pre-state, right? I should correct myself. It's not the state yet, right? It's the land of Israel being resettled, right? The relationship to the first and the second Aliyot.
The ideals
of Zionism, right? The emergence of the state, I should say. With those two things in mind, or three things, right? That the book is, for lack of a better term, is anchored in the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth is a book that meditates on the complex relationship that people can have with the state of Israel, especially when times are hard, or the land of Israel when things are hard. And the emphasis that the book of Ruth has on symbolic names to hide, right, and to pack levels of meaning into this complexity, let's come back to the story of the Agunot, and let's take all the protagonists' names. Let's find out who they are. So let's start with Yechezkel, okay? So, in the story of the Agunot, Yechezkel is the son-in-law. He's the Talmud scholar brought from Poland. Now, in the story, however, there's some criticism. There's some criticism of the father of Achiezer for bringing Yechezkel, because some of the people say, though not to his face, why are you bringing a scholar from outside the land of Israel? Right? Can't you find anybody good enough in the Holy Land, in the holy city of Jerusalem? So Yechezkel, in the story, is already identified as the Jew of the Galut. He's the Jew of the Galut. He's the Jew of the exile. Now, isn't it interesting? Now, who is Yechezkel in Tanakh? Yechezkel is the prophet of the exile. He's the only prophet who prophesies in exile. If you look, now Agnon loves building on Midrashim, on statements of the Talmud. So you look at number 6. This is a passage from Moed Katam. Rav Nachman Bar Chista raised an objection against this, and some say it was Rav Chanan Bar Chista. He said, is it, right, because the previous line which I didn't give you said that you can't have a prophet outside the land of Israel. And the Talmud said, is it not stated that the words of the Lord came, Hayo Haya, to Ezekiel the priest, Yechezkel, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans? Didn't he get prophecy outside of Israel? Which, right, thereby implying that a prophet can prophesy outside of Eretz Israel, outside of Israel? So the Talmud says, his father tapped him with his sandal on his foot, thereby hinting to him that he should be quiet. He said to him, have I not told you not to trouble everyone with questions in the middle of a eulogy? Right, this is a eulogy. Right? The Gemara answers the question, what is the meaning of the doubling of the word came in Hayo Haya? It implies that it had already come before, meaning that Yechezkel already begun to prophesy in Eretz Israel, and his prophecy in Babylonia was merely a continuation of that prophecy. The Talmud tells you there is but one prophet who prophesies outside of Israel, Yechezkel, and he can only do that because he's rooted in the land of Israel. Now let's come back to the story. Yechezkel is, right, the Talmud scholar that comes from far away. He comes to Jerusalem. He reverses the path of Yechezkel, who begins his inspiration in Israel and leaves the land of Israel. Yechezkel, in the story, gets his inspiration from outside the land of Israel. It comes to Israel. And
take a Midrashic story as the truth. It's nice. but it's not the truth.
I'm not trying to take it as truth or not. I'm trying to, but Agnon builds on Midrashim, right? Right? In the Talmud, right? Agnon as he says, builds on, as he always does, on Midrashim, on the words of Chazal, and whether they're the meaning of the text or not is less relevant to the fact that Agnon draws on the images of Chazal and the images of the rabbis. And even if it's not the simple meaning of the story, the point is that, according to the sages, there is this midrash that identifies Yechezkel's struggle, right? Yechezkel being the only prophet who gains inspiration from Israel and then leaves the country. But you can't, right? According to the Talmud, you can't prophesize outside of Israel. Inspiration needs to come from Israel. And in the story, what do you find? You find that the scholar, the inspired scholar from outside of Israel, comes to Israel, the reverse journey of Yechezkel. And what does Agnon say everyone criticizes? How can you have someone who comes from... What's there in Poland that's not here in the land of Israel? And what ends up happening at the end of the story? He leaves, he goes back, because his inspiration started in Poland. And if you start in Poland, right, there's going to be something lacking in your prophecy, in your inspiration. If you look, what?
He actually loses it.
Right, he loses it. If you look at eight, this is actually from the story, right? Look at this, right? From Agunot. And when the time of love arrived, his father dispatched a great many emissaries to all corners of Israel's dispersion to seek after a boy befitting the law, a joy whose like could not be found in all the world. And here the Satan interfered, and not without cause did all begin to gossip and intimate that a man had affronted all the houses of studies and yeshivot in the Holy Land by seeking a groom for his daughter from among the children of the exile of all things outside the land. Right? This is not me, right? Agnon draws attention to the fact that there's criticism that he's from the exile. But who would dare to say to such a noble and luminary, what are you doing? The dignitary saw that his plans had been realized with all success and said in his heart, now it's only fitting that this groom should teach in my grand yeshiva in the holy city Jerusalem may be rebuilt and strengthened, and from all the world students will flow to hear Torah and tradition from Zion. What's the irony here? Right? What's Agnon telling you? I'm going to bring the scholar from outside the land of Israel so that people will be inspired by Israel. But it doesn't work. It's the reverse. He's playing on the midrashic vision of Yechezkel of someone who can only offer inspiration outside of Israel because he started in Israel. But Yechezkel in the story, as his father-in-law envisions him, is going to be able to represent Israel, but he can't because he represents Poland. And in the story, Yechezkel pines away for Poland. And as many scholars have pointed out, who does he pine away for? Fredela, which is the only name in the story in Yiddish. It's the only...
And it means joy.
Right.
Happiness. It's
right.
That's the opposite of what everybody there is.
Exactly. And where's the happiness found? In Poland, in Yiddish. Right? Yechezkel is someone whose inspiration in the story comes from outside the land of Israel, so he's an unnatural fit in Israel. So Yechezkel is, right, if you think about it, it's a mediation, it's a meditation, it's a rumination about what happens to the Jew who wants to come to Israel, but is in the end of the day a gullus Jew, is an exile Jew. Will he be able to transform? Will he be able to speak the Torah of Zion? And the answer that Agnon gives is not necessarily. Right, if he still pines for Fredela, if he still pines for Yiddish, if he still pines for Poland, then he can't represent Israel. Right, he plays on Yechezkel, the prophet of the Galut, the prophet of the exile, but he flips it, he reverses it, and he says Yechezkel only worked. You could only prophesy in exile if you were rooted in the spirit of Jerusalem. But you won't be able to be the prophet of Jerusalem if you're rooted in the spirit of Poland. Right? And how does he tell you that? By calling him Yechezkel. By alluding to the complex relationship that Yechezkel had. He is the prophet that leaves. He's the prophet that struggles because he sees the exile. He starts in Israel and then leaves as right through the trauma of exile. But this Yechezkel is living through the reverse. He's given the opportunity to come back, to reverse the exile, to reverse the problems of the diaspora, but he can't shake it because he's still in Poland. Even when he's there physically, his soul remains. His soul belongs to Fredela. And if you look in 7, to look at one more midrash, Reb Nechemiah said to Reb Yehuda, if it was the truth, why do you refer to it as a parable? And if it was a parable, why do you refer to the truth? The Talmud here is referring to the dry bones. Right? There's the vision of the dry bones, that Yechezkel sees these dry bones coming back to life. Now, what is the prophecy of the dry bones? So Yechezkel sees it, right, a prophecy of dry bones coming back to life. Now, the Talmud has a dispute whether it's in fact only a prophecy or in fact happens, that he sees dead people coming back to the land of Israel. Now, what's the dispute? What's the argument? So some say that it means literally that these were dead people and are coming back to life. If it's not that, then what is it? Well, remember, he's prophesizing in the exile. He's telling them the exile will one day end. So what does he see? These dead bones will one day have flesh returned to them, right? He sees the dead bones come back to life. And the Talmud says, how can you say, right, it's a parable, right? If it's a parable, why do you refer to the truth? Rather, it means in truth it was a parable. So Reuelzer, son of Reuelzer Glili, says, not only was it not a parable, the dead that Yechezkel revived, right, these dead bones that he gave life to, ascended to Eretz Yisrael. They ascended to Israel, married wives, fathered sons and daughters, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira stood on his feet and said, I am a descendant of their sons, and these are phylacteries that my father's father left from them. Right? The Talmud builds this image around Yechezkel, that Yechezkel is the one who enabled the dead, meaning the exile, the people whose spirit had been crushed and died in the exile, to return to Israel. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira says, I am their descendant, meaning I, as a leading rabbinic scholar, I'm them, and look, my tefillin, my religious inspiration comes from those dead bones, which left Galut. Meaning Yechezkel, according to the Talmud, is the one who, if this story really happens, right, what's the Talmud telling you? If it really happened, what is the message? And even if it's a prophecy, the same thing is true, that the exile will be reversed. One day the nation that has been dead, or that hasn't had a state, that hasn't had a nation, that hasn't been alive for 2,000 years, the bones will return to their flesh, and they'll go up to Israel, and they'll marry, and they'll bring back inspiration. And Yehuda ben Beseira says, I'm it. Look, if you're inspired to return to Israel, look what can come. You can marry. Remember, marry and teach Torah. Right? Right? Sound familiar? Right? Yechezkel enables. Right, or he is supposed to enable. He's supposed to come up. He's supposed to marry Dina in Israel. He's supposed to teach Torah and offer inspiration in the land of Israel. And he can't. He can't. He can't shake that. He can't move on. Yechezkel enabled people. The prophet Yechezkel enabled the dead bones to be revived and returned to Israel in the Midrashic image. And Yechezkel in our story can't do it. Yechezkel can't do it.
Well, who really has the inspiration? I think it's the father of Dina.
Ah.
The father of Dina, I don't remember his name.
Achiezer. We'll come to Achiezer.
This is the way I read the story, is this young kid, pardon me, yeshiva, young rabbi, and Avnon doesn't really give him much description. He's not inspired, this Yechezkel.
No, but they think he is, right? He's the best of the best.
Where does
he's good looking, he's smart.
Right, he does. He says he's the jewel that cannot be found in all the world, right?
Yeah.
He's this unique scholar. It turns out he's not.
Who sees him as a jewel, though, Dina's father?
Correct. Dina's father, presumably based on the testimony of those in the exile, right? In the diaspora, those who view the world in the diaspora.
He didn't know about the feeling that he has for the other guy.
Correct, and he doesn't know. He doesn't know that he's in love with the Galut. He doesn't know that he's in love with exile, right? He thinks he can extricate him. He can bring him back, and it doesn't work, right? So, what is Avnon doing by playing with Yechezkel? He's telling you that, in theory, it's possible, right, to reconcile a dual identity if you're rooted where? If you're rooted in Israel. But if you feel yourself rooted in Poland, you can't be the prophet of the exile. There's no such thing as a prophet of the exile. There's only a prophet who begins in Israel and goes to the exile. But you can't come from the exile and be the prophet of Jerusalem. Right? And Fredel, we've already talked about. Ben Uri. Who's Ben Uri? Ben Uri is
the artist.
Right, what? Is the artist. Now this stares you in the face. This is easy, right? Ben Uri. So if you look at 9, let's first read it in the Agunot, right? What did he do? He sent for and gathered all sort of the greatest craftsmen and built a stately palace, plastered it and painted it and frescoed it and brought wagonfuls of precious holy books, not a word lacking among them for the study of Hashem, for of God. He designated too a small sanctuary for prayer and decorated with all types of finery and summoned the worthiest scribes to write a Torah scroll and silversmiths to craft adornments for the holy books and scrolls. And what was the point of all this? So that prayer of that young scholar would be near to his teachings and in a place in which one would find it proper to say, this is my God and I shall enshrine him. Right now, Ze Eli Ve'anvehu, translated as I will enshrine him, refers to, what is enshrine? Right? I will build a shrine to him, meaning the Beit HaMikdash. Ze Eli Ve'anvehu, Chazal have many different interpretations of it. Right? One of them is, I will create a naveh, I will create a home. Right? Ze Eli Ve'anvehu, which is clearly what it means here. Right? That he gathered together the best artists and the best scribes to create a synagogue that people could say, Ze Eli Ve'anvehu, I enshrine him, meaning, I'm creating the Mishkan, the tabernacle, or the Beit HaMikdash, right? Or the temple in Jerusalem, right? He wants to create the temple in Jerusalem. And furthermore, the dignitary gave his thoughts over to improving and beautifying the house of Hashem, right? All this language is temple language, right? The craftsmen, all those, right? The house of God with all manner of lovely decorations, and set his heart towards building a holy ark that would exceed all others in beauty, the sort of splendid work the like of which no ayin had seen, ayin lo ra'ata. Okay, now, who is the artist who builds the first tabernacle? You want to build the tabernacle in Jerusalem, so who do you get?
Bezalel.
Right, Bezalel, whose father is? Uri. Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. Right, you look at number 2. In Shemot, when the Torah tells you who builds the first tabernacle, Vayidaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Re'e Karati V'Shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur Lemate Yehuda. Who do you call Bezalel ben Uri? Right, Ben Uri. This, right, he's not, Agnon is not leaving this one up to chance, right? He's telling you, let me tell you, this is the Beit HaMikdash, right? This is the Mishkan in, well, he's sort of leaving it up to chance. He's playing with you just a little bit. He's telling you clearly this is Bezalel, because this shul is supposed to be, well, what's the shul supposed to be? There's two possibilities. Either the Beit HaMikdash, which is the culmination of the Mishkan, right? The temple, which is the culmination of the tabernacle, which would mean that this is supposed to be the temple in Jerusalem. But what did Ben Uri actually build? What did Bezalel Ben Uri actually build? The well, he built the Mishkan, but where was the Mishkan? In the desert, right? It's the precursor to the temple in Jerusalem. But Bezalel actually doesn't build the Beit HaMikdash. That's done by Shlomo. That's done by Solomon. He builds the Mishkan, which is what the Beit HaMikdash looks like when it's not yet in the land of Israel. Right? So he hires Bezalel to create the temple in Jerusalem, but there's a problem because he's not creating the temple in Jerusalem. Bezalel never built the Beit HaMikdash. He built the Mishkan. He built the tabernacle in the diaspora, in the desert. So here, Achiezer is trying to build the temple in Jerusalem by getting the best artist in the world, but he finds the artist who could only build the temple of the Galut, or not the really the Galut, of the pre-Israel. Right? Of the pre-Israel. Right? Well, that fits the story, doesn't it? Right? Bezalel comes and builds the Aron. He builds the Beit HaMikdash, but he doesn't build the Beit HaMikdash. He builds the home for Yechezkel. And Yechezkel is from the exile. Right? And in Jerusalem, remember, what happens to his Aron? It disappears. It's never used. Because he can't be used in Jerusalem. Because he's Ben Uri, because he comes from the world of pre-Israel. Right? He is living in a different world. Try building it there and it won't work. It disappears, right? It magically disappears at the end of the story. No one knows where it goes. And the other descriptions are also, right, found in this, right? If you want to know that this is from the Mishkan, right, the rest of them come from here as well. So what do we have so far in the story? We have the husband is the prophet of the exile, who is supposed to come and inspire the land of Israel with his Polish Torah, but can't because he pines for the old world. You have an attempt to build the temple in Jerusalem, but you can't because you hired the person who built the Mishkan, which is pre-Israel, right? It doesn't work. Right? And then who is? The father-in-law. Okay, so who's this father-in-law? Who instigated this whole thing? Right? Achiezer. Now, who's Achiezer? So here, it could be a lot of things, right? Now, it could be at a modern level, and I don't know whether he is influenced by this. It could be. The Achiezer is the name of the most prominent work written by the most prominent rabbi of that time, who was the rabbi of, right, in Europe. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudensky was considered the greatest rabbinic authority of the time in Europe, and his work is Achiezer. His Book of Esrei is Achiezer. There's also stories about him that he was invited to come to Israel and turned it down because the Galut needed him, because he felt he was needed. So it could be that there's a modern connotation to Achiezer, right, that he's talking about those who are inspired by the Galut. But if we want biblical resonances, right, so there actually is one which suggests itself without even stretching itself. So Achiezer is, in Tanakh, in Chumash, look at 11, Lidan Achiezer ben Amishadai. Right, he is the Nasi, he is the leader, he is the tribal leader of the tribe of Dan, Achiezer. Now, why the tribe of Dan, of all things? So let me first suggest what someone else has suggested, not me, okay? But then I'm going to come to what I think actually is going on. So there's a scholar, a modern scholar, Dina Stern, who wrote an excellent article, on a very long article, on the Agunot. She suggests that Achiezer is connected to Dan, which he is, obviously, he's the tribal leader of Dan, because Dan is in turn related to Dinah in two ways, right? You think about it, meaning, right, once you realize Achiezer is from Dan, then Achiezer is connected to his daughter, Dinah, right? But also, if you look at, if you look at 6, right, Atomer Rachel, Danani Elohim, V'gam Shama Bekoli, V'yitin Liben, Akein Kara Shemo, Dan, right? Dan also refers to God vindicating, right, someone, to God judge it, right, to God vindicating someone. Now, right, he is, Achiezer here is, right, trying to find his own sort of, right, vindication through, right, marrying off his daughter Dinah, who's named the same word, right, by marrying her off to the Yisri Chezkel, right, so he connects it to this notion of vindication and judgment, and he notes that Dan often is like that, right, if you look in 13, Dan Yadin Amo, Dan is the judge, Kachat Shivtei Yisrael, but I would suggest that two other resonances to Achiezer that I think are more compelling than that. I don't think it's impossible that she wanted to play with Dan and Dinah. There's actually something much more that suggests itself. The tribe of Dan, right, which Achiezer would have led, Achiezer ben Amishadai, is, if you look in 14, is Benasa Degel Machane Vnei Dan Me'asef L'kol HaMachanot L'Tzivotam V'Altfo Achiezer ben Amishadai. Right. Who is Dan? So Dan is the rear guard of all the divisions. So when the Jews travel through the Midbar, they travel through the desert, Dan travels last as the rear guard to collect everyone, to make sure that anybody that fell behind, they are picked up, right? Which means that as they're traveling towards their destination, who ensures that any of the stragglers will make it to their final destination, which is Israel? It's the rear guard. Achiezer leads the rear guard of the people on their way to Jerusalem, on the way to Israel. Right? My guess is that Achiezer is literally the leader of the Ma'aseif L'Kol HaMachanot, because what does Achiezer say? He's bringing in a leader from the outside of Jerusalem to inspire people in Israel to bring people back to Israel. He wants to be the Ma'aseif L'Kol HaMachanot. He wants to be the, right, literally, it's the rear guard in English, but what it literally translates is he who collects all the camps, right? So Achiezer is the tribal leader of the tribe whose responsibility is to make sure that nobody falls behind on the journey to Israel. Also, who comes from the tribe of Dan? So who would have been the leader of Dan. If you look in 15, there's actually two people who build the Mishkan. One is Bezalel ben Uri, but he has an assistant, who is Lorot Natan Bilibo, who V'aliyav ben Achisamach L'mate Dan. There's two people who build the Mishkan. The main person is Bezalel ben Uri, and his assistant, who is from the tribe of Dan. Right? So, right, it also makes sense that, well, that's really what Achiezer is doing, isn't he? He's enabling ben Uri to build his Mishkan. And he's enabling the builder of the Mishkan to build. Well, that's what Achisamach L'mate Dan did. Right? So Achiezer would be the leader of Achisamach. So my guess is that it connects to those two points, is that Achiezer sees his role as, one, bringing people, all the stragglers, back to Israel, and two, as helping build the Mishkan, which is the job of, A, the tribe of Dan, and B, the representative of Dan in the building of the Mishkan. And if you look at 16, Rashi notes, right, that it's even more than that. He was of the tribe of Dan, of one of the lowliest of the tribes, of the sons of the handmaids, and yet the omnipresent placed him, guards the work of the tabernacle on a level with Bezalel, and he was a member of the noble tribes. He notes there's actually a tribe thing going on here, because Dan comes from, right, comes from the Shvachot, right, comes from the maidservants, which means he's a lower tribe, right? And yet, because he's inspired, and because he's inspired, he's put on the level of Ben Uri, right, of Judah, right, of a member of the representative of Judah who builds the Mishkan. In order to confirm what Scripture says, he regarded not the rich more than the poor, right? The message of having two people build the Mishkan, one from Dan and one from Judah, was to say that everybody, if only you're inspired enough, could build the Mishkan. Well, isn't that the point of the story? Right, that Yechezkel would have succeeded if only he had been inspired, but he wasn't inspired. Achiezer was inspired, but he didn't have a partner, right? If both of them had been inspired, it would have worked, but one of them didn't work, but both of them were necessary. You needed the financier, and you needed the inspiration. If both of them didn't work, it wouldn't succeed. If it had worked, then it didn't matter where you came from. You'd have a representative Judy or a representative Don. And Breshit Rabbah in the Midrash also gives another image, which I think Agnon may be building on. If you look in 17, the Midrash says as follows: Amar Bichamar Baruch Hanina, the Mashiach ben David, Sheyatza Mishnei Ashvatim, the Messiah will come from two tribes, Aviv mi Yudah, v'imo mi Dan. His father will be from Judah, and his mother from Dan. Right. So in the Midrashic tradition, how does the return to Israel happen in the hands of the Messiah? From a representative of Judah and a representative of Dan. In our story, who's heralding in this messianic vision? It's right, Ben Uri, the builder of the ark, and Achiezer, the financier, the right, the inspiration. V'shnein k'tiv, arayot gurayeh Yudah, Dan gurayeh. So my guess is that Agnon is trying to draw on this and say, well, yeah, Israel, we can return to Israel, we can bring about a messianic age, right? We have the key elements. We have a Yehudah, a Ben Uri, and we even have a representative from Dan. That's not going to work. It's not going to work because they're not inspired, because it's being made for Yechezkel, but Yechezkel can't come back because he pines for the Galut. And besides, we can't come to the Messiah because we're not building the Beit HaMikdash. I'm trying to build the Beit HaMikdash, but he hired not Solomon, he hired Ben Uri. He hired the artisan of the tabernacle, the one who knows how to build religiosity outside the land of Israel. But you can't bring the Messiah if the one who builds only knows how to build the shuls of the exile, the shuls of the diaspora. And so suddenly, let's return to our story, right? And the key names, right? What's our story? Our story starts off by Achiezer, right? Half the picture of the Messiah, inspired to bring, I mean, that's what he wants to do, doesn't he? He wants to build the temple in Jerusalem. Isn't that how he describes it? He wants to say that Torah will come forth from Jerusalem. So he looks towards the exile, and he looks to as Dan does, Be'masef l'kol ha'machanot, find those who are straggling in on their way to Israel, and he tries to bring them. So he brings Yechezkel. Yechezkel is someone who knows how to straddle both worlds. But Yechezkel in the Bible is one who takes his inspiration from Israel and can inspire the diaspora because his heart lives in Israel. But it's not going to work if you have a Yechezkel who pines for Fredela. It's not going to work if your heart's in Poland. He hires an artisan, the best artisan, to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the temple, as it were, in Jerusalem. But he missteps. He doesn't build the temple in Jerusalem. He builds the tabernacle. He builds the tabernacle, which is from the pre-Israel world. Right? He thinks he's going to bring the Messiah because he'll bring a member of Judah, a Ben Uri, along with himself, a member of Dan, the leader of Dan. Together we'll bring Messiah, we'll inspire Israel. Can't do it. Can't do it if your inspiration is still in the exile, if you're still stuck in the exile. And then we get to our last character, Dina. Dina, this poor girl who's married off to who wants to marry Ben Uri, but is married off to Yechezkel. Now, who is Dina? So Dina is, now here, so Dina, we know, we've summarized the story. She is the daughter. When do we find out her name? We find out her name at the end of the story, in chapter 3, or whatever, the third section, like 75% through, right? She's called the daughter for a very long time. What book do we have where we don't find out about a spouse for a very long time? The book of Ruth, right? The book of Ruth, right? The story which comes from Ruth, remember that little thing I hinted to, that we don't find out who Ruth was married to until the very end of the story. Well, guess what? We don't find out who this woman is till the very end of the story. Right? It's a flip. We don't find out who Yechezkel is supposed to marry till the very end, because her identity is not that important, is it? Right? Her identity isn't important. She's supposed to marry Yechezkel and bring to fruition the dreams of her father. That's her purpose in the story. Right? Her name isn't that important. We find out later, when we do find out her name is tragic, because she's Dina. Who's Dina? Right? Dina is raped. Right? She's raped, but by who? Right? She's raped by, right? Right, Beshrem ben Chamor, by someone who lives in Israel. And actually, I didn't put this, I should have put it, but what does Jacob say at the end? Right, Shimon and Levi are indignant. How could she be raped by Shechem ben Chamor? And what does Yaakov say? I'm scared to respond to the rape. Why? Because, right, you've made me disgusting, Kol Yoshvei Haaretz, to all those who live in the land. Right, meaning there are other people, there's another culture in the land that I haven't gotten rid of yet. Right? And that culture raped Dina, right? She's the one raped by someone who lives in Israel, but his culture isn't Jewish. And who's Dina? This poor girl married off to someone who's in Israel, but whose culture is external, right? She's being forced into a marriage by her father, right? Sound familiar? Right? Yaakov makes a deal with Chamor. Right? She's raped against her will, and then he says, let me marry you off to this prince. She's never asked whether she can be married to him, but her father says, sure, that'll be the way that we settle the land. We'll make a treaty. Right? We'll live in this land. We'll become part of this land. We'll become settled in this culture, but she's never asked. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work, because her brothers stand up for Jewish pride, and they say, we're not marrying, our daughter can't, our sister can't, right, be treated, right, as a harlot. She can't be raped. You can't force her into marriage, right? Dina is the only person in Tanakh, right? She is the person in Tanakh who gets raped by someone who lives in Israel but isn't an Israelite, right? Who opens a seeming opportunity to integrate into the culture but is turned down. Right? And as I mentioned, her name isn't even important till the end of the story, just like, right, Kilion, right, from the book of Ruth, from which the Agunot derives its name. So you put all the names together. And you wonder, why do people say the Agunot is a rumination on the complex relationship that the modern Jew has with the land of Israel? Because think about the story. It's the story of Achiezer, of this man who wants to bring the Messiah, who recognizes opportunity in the land of Israel, but wants not just to inspire those in the land, but to bring those from outside the land, right? To recognize, he brings those people who haven't yet come in to the country, right? How do we know he's messianic? Because he wants to build a temple in Jerusalem. That's what he says. That's his shul. Right? That's what he wants. That's what he says explicitly. And he wants to bring about the situation of Kimitzion Tetzei Torah, Dvar Hashem, Mirushalayim, that the Torah should come out from Jerusalem. He wants to create that even for those from the exile. So he doesn't ask his daughter. And he says, here, I'll marry you off to our hope, to Yechezkel. Yechezkel is a person who's indeed found in Israel, but she's forced into a marriage with a person who's found in Israel. Now, Dinah is forced to sleep. She's raped. Instead, Dinah of the Agunot is forced into a marriage that's never consummated. It's the inverse. But she's forced into a marriage with someone who lives in Israel, but whose heart is outside Jerusalem, just like Shechem ben Hamor is in the land of Israel, but not the people of Israel, right? He's the land that's going to be, he's a member of the nation that will one day be expelled, that will one day be kicked out when it's time for the Jews to return. And it's that type of figure, that person who's physically in Israel, but isn't part of the spirit of Israel, who marries this poor girl, Dinah. And she pines away, right, for somebody else, for Ben Uri, for this person who can possibly build the Beit HaMikdash, but he really can't, because he doesn't know how to build a temple in Jerusalem. He knows how to build the temple of the exile, or the pre-Israel, more carefully, not the exile, pre-Israel. He can bring inspiration, but he knows how to build the tabernacle. He doesn't know how to build the temple. He's Bitzanel ben Uri. And Yechezkel, why does he fail? Why can't he become the prophet of Jerusalem? Because he pines for Fredela, he pines for the only Yiddish name, he pines for the girl in Poland. And then if you take it outside of the story, and then you still go to the level of metaphor, then you realize, yeah, right, that's exactly where Agnon saw himself. Agnon was a person raised in Israel, but inspired, raised outside of Israel, but inspired by Israel, inspired to come. Inspired to come back, but his relationship was always complex. He went back for a few years, and even when he came, right, he carries with him the traditions. He's always haunted by his past. He writes stories about which mimic or capture his life in his hometown, in Chachkas, right? Or why? Because he comes to Israel, but he can't leave the past behind. He tries, but he can't quite. He wants to inspire Israel. He wants to write in Hebrew. This is his first attempt. Right? This is his first attempt. He's been writing in Yiddish. He's been channeling the spirit of the exile, and now he wants to write in Hebrew. He thinks he can, but he knows that it'll be hard. He's not sure he'll be able to have the pure spirit because he was born outside. He was raised also in the culture of Germany. And he struggles his entire life in this dual identity of very much wanting to be the Hebrew writer, the Hebrew poet and master of literature, but knowing that he carries with him a tradition which he can't shake and doesn't really want to shake. And he's not the only one. So what does he name himself? He names himself Agnon, because this is a biography, right? This is a story about people who are grappling with what it would mean to bring the culture of the exile back to Israel, recognizing it's not easy, or in fact, maybe the opposite, thinking it's easy, but finding it too complex, finding it too hard to shake the spirit of the exile. People who want to prophesize from Jerusalem, who want to be, as Yechezkel was supposed to be, the person who inspired people, right, in Hebrew, in Jerusalem, from the temple, but finding that their heart still belongs to Fredela, right? Finding that their temple is not a temple, it's a tabernacle, it's from pre-Israel, and even that, their own disappears. And even that, the inspiration disappears, it gets built, right? You see redemption in sight, and then it disappears and is never used. And Ben-Uri flees and disappears, and we don't know what happens to him because he's driven away, because he's committed, right? He's committed to his art. He's not committed to Dinah. Right? And Dinah has a complex relationship. She's married to Yechezkel. She wants Ben-Uri, right? She gets neither. Right, she gets neither the person who could have built the temple nor the person who should have been the prophet of the right of the returned Israel. She gets neither, because one is committed to his art and one is committed to Freidela. And the rabbi in the story, at the end of the story, leaves Israel to search the world for the souls that are still moored, and tells his daughter, don't look for me, because I'm going through the world, not through Israel, I'm leaving Israel, I'm going back into the Galut, because there are poor souls which are anchored, which are stuck, are neither here nor there. They're still married to the exile, but they want to be married to Jerusalem, but they can't shake either relationship. I need to go. Don't look for me. And Agnon writes the Agunot about himself. He's everybody in the story, right? He's the person who wants to inspire Jerusalem. He's the person who feels his connection to the exile. He's the person who feels that it's his job to inspire people to break free and actually enter the culture, but he's not sure he can do it himself, so he wanders. And he wanders emotionally and sometimes physically and goes back for a few years here and there. So forever he names himself Agnon. He names himself after this story, where every name, like the Book of Ruth, from which it derives its name, meditates on the complex relationships people can have with the land of Israel and the people of Israel. And I suggest that that's what's going on in the Agunot. He's taking his cue from the Book of Ruth, both recognizing from the plot of the Book of Ruth the power that both Israel can have and the exile can have, and also recognizing that so much is in a name, that if you just know how to pack it in, you can tell people without telling people. Right? So he references back to this story about, which, if you think about it, is a story which seems to be about marriage, but it's not about marriage. It's about people who marry into a foreign culture. And in that story, what's the irony of Ruth? Who returns? Not the Israelite, but the Moabite, right? The Israelites die in the culture of Moab because they abandoned Israel. And the Moabite who embraces Amech Ami ve'Elokayech Elokai, the God and the Spirit of Israel, is the one who returns, who transforms Naami, turned Mara, pleasantness, turned bitterness back to pleasantness. But that only comes because of Ruth, who can magically bring the spirit of the exile back when her husband left Israel and dies in exile. The Book of Ruth, on its surface, is a book about marriage, but is really a book about how hard it is to fully embrace Israel as a nation and as a land and as a nation, as a people. And that's what the Agunot's about. It seems like a story of a marriage, but it's not the story of a marriage. It's the story of a marriage which represents the struggle of real people with cultures and lands and nationhood. And I suggest that that's why the story the Agunot names become so important. Because name is identity. Identities become so important and are so symbolic, and why it becomes his pen name, right? He picks his pen name from a story that's about names, that's about identities, that's about the struggle. So each of the names in the Agunot references stories that highlight the complexity of our relationship with Israel. And his name, Agnon, reflects a story about stories which reflect the complexity of returning to Israel. And I suggest that that's what he got from the Torah. When he tells you that he was inspired by Tanakh, I don't think he's joking, right? Tanakh plays with names to hide meaning, to hide identity. So he does the same thing. He becomes the next link in the chain and brings the reader into the tradition of Israel in order to tell you who he is. And who he wants to be, but he's not sure he can become. So that's my suggestion of what Agnon does with names and the Book of Ruth, right, to forge his own identity, which is a symbolic name built on symbolic names, built on symbolic names, which is a story within a story, right, which is the two parts of Agnon, his struggle with the land of Israel and his commitment to, right, symbolic literature, where he hides his life story without telling it to you. So that's my interpretation, at least, of the book of the Agunot and the role of symbolic names in Agnon. So with that, I open it up. Right, and that's why I suggest that he's building on the Talmudic tradition, right? Meaning, again, whether or not the Talmudic tradition is the pshat, is the simple read of the story, the fact is that Agnon, part of, you know, the canon that he's using, that he's building on, is Yechezkel, and the image of the Midrash, right? Yechezkel is the person who only succeeds outside of Israel because he's inspired by the land of Israel. So, you're right, maybe, right, from reading Tanakh, you could say, yeah, Yechezkel is the person who manages to be inspired outside the land of Israel. But from a Midrashic perspective, right, Yechezkel is the one who can only succeed if he's inspired by Israel in the diaspora,
but
right?
It's not just that he's inspired outside, it's really a symbol to come about that you can really worship even outside of Israel.
Correct, and that's the irony, right? The irony, that's what I point out also from the, you know, that powerful story in the Talmud, right? That the dry, right? He, yes, you're right, he's the story that the dry bones will one day return, right? But when the bones of Yechezkel himself in the story return, he pines away and he goes back. And the truth is, if you look at the story, right, it's not just Yechezkel emotionally pines away, right? They see it on his face, or in other words, right, he's dying in front of you, right? Meaning it's the reverse of the image of the dry, right, of the dry bones, right? The dry bones, life is given to them, right, and they can return to Israel. This Yechezkel, right, life is being sucked out of him because his heart is elsewhere, right? Yeah. Right, so
because he returns to Israel, they say there's sightings.
There's sightings of him, exactly.
And the little baby that he's holding, I wonder is it his literature?
And I do wonder that, right, whether he's the rabbi, right, where he is, right, he's going to bring back the moored souls, right, the anchored souls, and yeah, it could be it's the bait, right, it could be it's his literature, it could be it's his hopes and his dreams, right, there's all types of things that could be symbolized in the infant there, but I think you're right, right, that's, right, I'm not married to him being only the rabbi, I think he's definitely also the rabbi, right, who's seeking the souls, right, that goes out of Israel and comes back and inspires people and tries to save them. I'm not sure he's only, right? He could also be, you know, a little bit of Yechezkel and a little bit of Ben-Uri, meaning the, right, the line between the physical arts and literature, right? There's no reason Agnon didn't see himself as the artist as well, right? I could see him being pretty much anyone in the story, right? I could see him being, you know, because he was also the person who really thought people should return to Israel. I could see him seeing himself in Achiezer, right? I could see him seeing himself in Dina in the way she pines away. I'm not totally sure. I assume not Freidela, right? Freidela probably not. But I'm not married to him only being the rabbi, right? But I think he does see himself in this story. The most suggestive one is the rabbi because he's the one who utters that phrase that becomes Agnon's name, right? So that is the most suggestive, that he's this mythical rabbi who, you know, goes to the world to bring back the souls. I think that's right, right? What the baby represents could be his literature. I don't know, right? Yeah.
I have to thank you.
We had a question behind you, and then we'll.
I just got a question.
Yeah.
No, but question. I'm just telling something.
Okay. Okay. Go.
It's interesting. We go all around the circles, and yet Agnon, living in Palestine, Israel, never lived in the old city or anywhere where you would have put him because of his writings. He lived in a very secular area of Jerusalem.
That's interesting.
And that is something that people forget.
Which is interesting. That is definitely interesting. That he lives in Jerusalem. I'll just.
He picked a place. There wasn't even a synagogue me. I had to walk quite a bit. I come from the same place, so I know. But the whole attitudes, it's one thing here, but it's another thing there.
It's true, and the truth is that, you know, Agnon in his life also struggles not just, you know, struggles not just with his, you know, dual identity, you know, inside, outside of Israel. He struggles with his religiosity also, right? He's somebody, right, who, you know, at different stages in his life was, you know, committed to tradition in different ways. Oh, for sure, but, you know, but his connection to tradition was, you know, at different points different, right? He had his portions of his life where he was less committed, more where he was, you know, different portions where he was committed, right? You know, he's someone who also struggles with tradition. He struggles with geographical connections, right? And I think that's true.
Well,
yes.
I have to thank you. I was thinking of something extraneous to the wonderful lecture, but the first thing is that the Yeshiva University is sending the best people to Toronto. The Toronto community deserves to have such great scholars like you are.
Thank you.
The second thing, you're going to Efrat.
Yes.
And that's where Jeffrey Sachs lives in Efrat.
Yes, I know. He
so
is
that's
the,
going to be a center of Agnon studies.
He is the expert.
Yeah.
That is for sure.
And you're an expert, too.
Oh, thank you.
I've heard many stories, but I think the way that you've analyzed this story has been really remarkable. Also, so linking it with Ruth, that I've heard many years to study as Ruth, and never from that point of view, but mostly for Ruth as being brought into as an outsider, because at that time when the Shoftim, it was supposedly written in Ezra's time when the people came back, and to say I always say converts are better than the local product, you know, and so in that, but you're linking those things that with Agnon and his own personal struggle, because I think he wrote this first story very early in 1920, maybe before he went to Germany, or was in Germany, or after. So, you know, it's that struggle you've really portrayed, and the interpretation of what he tried to portray through this story and the names and everything was really masterful.
Oh, thank
and
you.
On behalf of the group, I really want to thank you, because it was really, as somebody said, I don't know who Rabbi Thering. But now they know Rabbi Thering, and we watch it back, I'm sure, before you go to Efrat.
Oh, thank you.
And on behalf of the group, I want to. You must be a little thirsty for all that target, so it is just fascinating.
Well, thank you so
thank
much.
You very much.
And I'll just thank really thank you so much for having me, forcing me to, you know, rethink this story. Like I said, we won't get to this story, the other one, the Ha'aguna, not Agunot, but. If you read that story, you'll find something fascinating, which is our story is a story which, you know, seems to be about a couple and turns out to be about, you know, Israel and, you know, sort of big ideas. The story of the Ha'aguna is the opposite, right? It's a story which takes place with a lecturer, right? A person who gives a parable, this masterful, you know, midrashic parallel, which is, you know, it's all about these high ideas and God and the Jewish people, and this poor woman who thinks it's a literal story about, you know, a literal story and doesn't quite understand it, and comes home that night and tries to get her husband to explain the story, and he remains silent and ignores her, and she goes to sleep without him talking, right? So it's a story that starts with this high thing and ends with, right? So it's actually playing with it the opposite way. So, but I think connecting the Agunot and Ha'aguna would take a lecture for another time, but that's the unpublished story, well, or the not-so-famous story, Ha'aguna, which I gave you, which, if you're interested, you can see, which is his rewrite of a Hasidish tale. So that's another sort of angle to take in this story, but I'll leave that to another time.
You started actually with the two stories connecting two places in the Torah, but that's quite common.
Correct. Intertextuality happens all the time, right? All the time, right? At, you know, layer after layer after layer. Yes?
It's such a gloomy story.
Yeah, I know.
It's unredeemably gloomy. And even the people who are native to Israel are not able to transcend the confusion of their minds or whatever. And they're not making things any better. They just
I agree. It is definitely, yes.
The demise.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, the same thing can be true if you read Ha'aguna. It's also not exactly, not exactly a happy story.
So there's no
but,
solution here.
Yes, yes. I'm going to see if I can find the. Yeah, I just want to see if I can find a key line here, but I'm not probably not going to be able to in this story. Yeah, no, I'm not going to be able to, but okay, but that'll have to be a different time. But yeah, that story is also irredeemably gloomy. It's gloom upon gloom. It's multiple levels of gloom. It's really, it's a mashal about high things, which is captured in a story about a husband and wife, which then ends with this poor husband and wife. It's like it's a very, very gloomy, right? We're at multiple levels. But
But I don't think Avnon ever gives solutions. I think his greatness is in his questions. He asks many questions, never gives answers. We have to find our own answers.
Yeah, and he has other stories, obviously, which dwell in this connection, right? You know, which are lighter, a bit lighter, even if they aren't
right.
Fully happy, right? His story of the goat, right? Is it? You know, that's a much lighter story, right? It also dwells on the connection, the complex relationship between and yes, the poor child, Well, not the poor child. The poor father loses his child to Israel and kills his only connection back to Israel. Right? He's happy for the son who's in Israel and sad for the father's son. Not quite as gloomy a story, but also pretty gloomy. Yeah, he does write a bit gloomy sometimes because he wants you to struggle. You know.
In the heart of the story, one of the few stories.
Yeah, he has a few, you know. Not just not this one's not, right? A book that a story entitled The Agunot is not, you know, is not going to be so happy. Yeah. Okay. Well, if that's it, thank you so much for inviting me.
And we never have a secret.